I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Wealthy countries made deals with COVID vaccine manufacturers and have been stockpiling supplies, creating a system that some are calling a vaccine apartheid. That has resulted in poor countries left to fend for themselves, leaving their populations vulnerable to high rates of viral transmission. But this is a global pandemic, so what happens in one country affects all countries, delaying the ability to get on top of this public health crisis. The U.S. has bought many times the amount of vaccine it needs to inoculate all American adults. The Biden administration has offered millions of doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine to Mexico and Canada and pledged $4 billion to COVAX to help low-income countries purchase vaccines. Today on Radio Time, some of the ethical questions raised by vaccine nationalism and the threat it poses to ending the pandemic. And we have two guests who have joined us. Joining us by Skype from India is Achal Prabala, public health activist and coordinator for Access IBSA, which campaigns to access medicines in India, Brazil, and South Africa. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us is Krishna Udayakumar, who is a physician at Duke University, where he is the founding director of the Duke Global Health Innovation Center. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Good to join you today.
Good to have you both join us. And let me make sure our listeners can join us as well. Here's the email address. It's radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us 1-888-477-9499. Krishna, I'd like to begin with you and with a question about America, because I'm sure some Americans listening to what I just said were saying to themselves, what oversupply? I've been scrambling to get a vaccine in this country with long waits, either, you know, out in a parking lot somewhere or online. Help us understand, I guess, how we can understand what an oversupply actually entails.
Sure. Thank you, Marty, for the question.
Sure.
We have to really start from everything from who's bought doses to how are they being manufactured and where, all the way to how many people are actually getting jabs in arms as opposed to shots and vials. If we look overall, more than 8 billion doses of vaccine have been bought around the world, many more than have actually been produced so far. And of those, more than a billion have been purchased by the U.S. If we look just at the three vaccines that are currently available, the Pfizer-BioNTech, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson, we've purchased enough in the U.S. to be able to vaccinate 500 million people. That obviously isn't where we're at now because the production is still coming in, but just right from those three, not to talk about what's perhaps in the pipeline with AstraZeneca, with Novavax and others, we will have by June or July at the latest, hundreds of millions of doses beyond what we would need. So if we look at how many people have actually been vaccinated, more than 450 million people or doses have been delivered around the world, and more than a quarter of those, 127 million doses, just in the U.S.
So is it more, and I do want to talk about the rest of the world. That's frankly why the two of you are here, but just a quick follow-up to that. So is it, for the U.S. at least, a distribution problem as you see it?
In the short term, it's a supply challenge that we are ramping up manufacturing capacity significantly month by month, but for right now, the demand still outstrips supply. I think that will change very rapidly in the coming weeks to months. So as we get into May, June, and July, we're going to have more doses on shelves or in freezers than people lining up to actually get vaccinations.
Achal Prabala, let me get you in on the conversation. Give us a more global perspective about where we stand as a world when it comes to vaccine supply, distribution, and even demand.
Thank you, Marty. And yes, I would love to do that. And I can do that best, I think, by following up on what Krishna just said. There's a difference between booking supplies of vaccines that are yet to come and actually receiving those supplies and being able to use them in the period since December 2020, when the first coronavirus vaccines came off the shelves and into the arms of people. And one of the best ways to understand that, I think, to look at what is happening in rich countries is the difference in the rollout in the United States versus a country like Canada, where the number of people who've been given at least one dose is just at 10%, much smaller than the rate in the United States and comparable to many countries in Europe who are also at about 10%. What's happened in some rich countries like the United States, like the United Kingdom, Israel, is that they were able to negotiate very early on, including with research commitments sometimes, in order to get right to the front of the queue, and also benefited from having some of these doses being produced within their borders. And that stood them in good stead when the vaccines came to market, because they were among the first to get them. Countries like Canada and countries in the European Union negotiated differently for different reasons. Canada negotiated large quantities of vaccines that haven't yet come to market, which is why they're facing a shortfall in supply. In the European Union, to some extent, there hasn't been enough research commitments that were made early on to get them at the front of the queue, and so they're facing supply problems as well. So this is what's happening in rich countries, and the only reason I bring that up is to say that it's actually not going that well in all rich countries uniformly. In the poorest countries in the world, as of today, there are 30 countries in the world who haven't dispensed a single vaccine dose to anyone.
Wow, not one.
Not one. If you dialed back a month ago or 2 months ago, that number was only greater. There are 92 countries who are officially classified as poor. And with the exception of a country like India, which is an anomaly because we have large-scale, high-volume vaccine manufacturers here who Western companies had to deal with in some way, most of the other countries a couple of months ago were in exactly the same situation. Okay. In middle-income countries, what we're seeing, which is to say countries like Latin American countries, Brazil, Bolivia, Peru, Chile, many Arab countries, Jordan, Egypt, Morocco, and Tunisia, large parts of Eastern Europe like Belarus, Hungary, Serbia, even some parts of Europe, and in Indonesia and Malaysia, what we're seeing is a huge move towards vaccines from China and Russia. These vaccines are filling a gap for countries who are too poor to receive charity and too rich to receive charity, rather, and too poor to be able to afford to have placed these large contracts with Western manufacturers.
Let me pick up on several things you said. And Krishna, I'd like to go back to you. On the one hand, we're talking about several months. It was really the end of December 2020 when these vaccines became available. Here we are almost at the end of March. So on the one hand, that seems extraordinarily fast. But on the other hand, it has shown this level of inequity when we look around the world. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, and Charles is exactly right in noting the inequities, not just among rich and poor countries, but among countries all around the world. And so if we take a step back, first we should celebrate the science that's allowed us to develop more than five effective and safe vaccines in under a year. We have talked about things being unprecedented. That certainly is unprecedented from a scientific accomplishment perspective. So we're in a really good place in terms of having vaccines that are effective and safe in a record time. The way that we're deploying them certainly leaves room for improvement in terms of equity. If we look at prior epidemics over decades, we are also in many ways better off than we were. So more than 100 countries have started their vaccination campaigns. Many poor countries have started at least the first vaccinations within months of the richest countries in the world doing that. And that's in large part because of the COVAX platform. So about a year ago, the planning started between the World Health Organization, Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, and CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation, to create a multilateral and global approach that could both invest in a portfolio of vaccines, but also make sure that we were leveraging financing from around the world to provide access to the poorest countries as quickly and equitably as possible. And they are on track to deliver more than 200 million doses to over 140 countries just in the first 6 months of this year. But nevertheless, we see that the majority of doses really are concentrated in a handful of countries. So we have learned from the past. There are both from a scientific as well as delivery perspective, things to be grateful for, but much, much room for improvement. Mm.
Talking about Operation Warp Speed, and this was, Krishna, what the U.S. was able to do last year to get these vaccines, frankly, to market and then into arms. Is the U.S. hoarding vaccines, or is it we're just trying to sort of figure out our need and the global need and how to fit all these puzzle pieces together?
Yeah, it's really hard to say that any country is hoarding at the moment. One, the U.S. through Operation Warp Speed put more than $10 billion very quickly to public and private resources to be able to develop vaccines very quickly. And because of that, as Achal mentioned, in many ways we're at the front of the line when the production lines start and vaccines are available. Right. What I think we need to really start asking ourselves now is how comfortable are we ethically from a health perspective as well? Do we really want to be at a place where we're vaccinating young, healthy individuals at a time when many frontline essential workers and vulnerable populations in low and middle income countries don't have access at all? So that's where the real equity conversation comes in. Are we going to be able to start sharing doses now or very soon? Or are we going to wait till everybody, including low-risk individuals, are vaccinated in the U.S. before we turn our sights to the rest of the world?
Achal, going back to you, as I mentioned in the introduction, we're talking about a pandemic. I mean, something that has affected every country in the world. So how do we sort of think together on this?
You know, I think one way is to start with looking at the injustice that's occurring right now. So in countries like Israel and the United Arab Emirates, which are have now vaccinated more than 50% of their populations, or even the UK and the United States, where we're between 20 and 35% of the populations, it's an interesting question as to why someone who's, let's say, my age, who's in his 40s, who has no known comorbidities that makes people like me vulnerable to the coronavirus, should get a vaccine, let's say, before an essential healthcare worker in the Central African Republic. But that is what's happening. That's what's happening across the world. And that's the scale of injustice, I think, that we have to look at to truly understand what this inequity means in pragmatic terms.
Well, I'll tell you what, we have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Achal Brabala, and he's a public health activist joining us from India, coordinator for Access IBSA, which campaigns for access to medicines in India, Brazil, and South Africa. Also with us is Krishna Udayakumar, and he's a physician at Duke University, where he is the founding director of the Duke Global Health Innovation Center. And we're getting a global perspective on this vaccine rollout related to COVID and also how to create a more equitable distribution system. We're going to take a very short break, and then we will get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with our guests about vaccine nationalism and the threat it poses to ending the pandemic and figuring out ways to make global distribution more equitable. Achal, let me pick up on what you said right before the break, which is that you're a healthy 40-year-old living in India. From a global perspective, how do we determine that someone who's, let's say, an essential worker with maybe some health risks in another country, Ghana, I mean, almost any other country in the world, that they should be in the head of the line before you or any other healthy 40-year-old? How do we do that in a global way?
So this is a great question, Marty, and this is something that the WHO tried to grapple with in the middle of last year, and they came up with something called an equitable allocation framework, which was a general guideline for how not only countries should give out doses within the country, but how the world should distribute doses with between countries. And their matrix was really simple. It was three categories of the most vulnerable people that they came up with. And the first was healthcare workers, who are obviously exposed to a very high risk of infection. And then senior citizens, so people over 60 or 65, and then people with comorbidities that we know affect their chances in the pandemic significantly. Now, they estimated that most countries would have about 20% of their populations comprising all three of these categories. And what they recommended really early on was to have all countries at first vaccinate these 20% of the most vulnerable people in their countries before proceeding to then expand vaccination programs to include others who are at less risk, right? But that, of course, didn't happen. And the reason it didn't happen is that we don't have a kind of global authority, as you said, that can enforce this rule across different countries. Many rich countries especially went into these bilateral deals, as Krishna noted, to secure a vastly greater numbers of doses than they require, even though, as also Krishna noted, it is hard to think of the US or other countries as hoarding vaccines when they're in fact also facing different degrees of shortages, in the short run at the least, to give out these vaccines. But what is true, however, is that that guideline that the WHO floated last year has been completely torn asunder, in the sense that that is not at all the way vaccines are being rolled out in the world.
Well, and I mean, Krishna, is it sort of every country for themselves?
It's not quite every country for themselves, but every country is trying to do what it can to look out for its own population and balance that with the tension of being a good global citizen for the most part. So in the U.S., we've committed $4 billion to support the COVAX initiative. We have donated doses to our neighbors, to Mexico and Canada, as you noted earlier. So we're trying to do small things along the way. We've noted using the Quad multilateral platform that we want to invest in making another billion doses available in the Asia-Pacific region by the end of 2022. All of those are fairly modest for now, but really what we're going to need to do is ramp up supply significantly to meet the current and future needs.
And we're talking about 8 billion people in the world. Let me read two emails, and Krishna, I'll put them to you only because, and I think they're related. George says, we didn't exactly buy a billion vaccines. We paid for their manufacture without knowing whether they would work or not. That's why we have all these vaccines on the books now, we meaning the United States. Dave says, first world countries paid for vaccine development, paid for the trials, and are paying the taxes to subsidize these initiatives. Shouldn't the first world now reap the benefits before the rest of the world? Krishna, can you respond to that? And Achal, you might want to weigh in on as well. But Krishna, go ahead, go first.
Yes, first, we should be grateful that the U.S. and other countries around the world made significant investments of tens of billions of dollars to make sure that the science was in place. But this was building on decades of effort from people and groups all around the world. So we should recognize we already are part of an interconnected and global economy. Secondly, even if we are self-interested in our own health and in our own economic growth, all of the models would tell you that we're better off in the U.S. if we share vaccine more equitably around the world. Other countries are not going to open up. Their markets will not be ready for American goods and services. We will not be safe, even if we're all vaccinated, when the coronavirus continues to be active anywhere else, and we open ourselves up to the potential for variants to develop that are going to outpace our ability to keep up with vaccination. So whether you think about this in a humanitarian perspective or a health perspective or purely self-interested economic perspective, the answer is still that we're better off by sharing doses more equitably.
And Achal, just thinking of these variants, and actually we'll be talking with our third guest in a couple of minutes about what we need to know about variants, but I'm thinking of the Brazilian variant or the South African variant, where some of these more lethal, if I can put it, strains of coronavirus are getting developed. And then, of course, you know, we're dealing with a UK variant here in the United States. Can you speak to that?
Look, this is certainly true that variants that come up anywhere in the world make the entire world less safe, whether vaccinated or not. However, in response to that email, I do think that there are a couple of things that we should be thinking of that we haven't. And the system of pharmaceutical monopolies that have made access to medicines, life-saving medicines, for AIDS in South Africa at the turn of the century, or hepatitis C in Brazil and Ukraine, or cancer in India, the system of pharmaceutical monopolies that has existed has been generally very bad for the world. It's disproportionately affected the poor countries that I live and work in, but it's also affected rich countries. We have crises of access to insulin in the United States, or PrEP. And I think what happened in the pandemic is a situation where many American viewers, watchers of this program might be under the impression, yes, of course, we should get a vaccine first in the United States since we paid for the development of it. But it's being presented as a us or them situation. And it's being presented as us or them because of an artificially constrained supply because of pharmaceutical monopolies that we have let run amok just as before in the pandemic. The United States government did have a choice. It's now become front page news in the Washington Post and the New York Times over the last couple of days. And I think the headline went something like this: how the United States bungled global coronavirus vaccine access. And this is absolutely true. This is what I've been working on for about 18 years, and it's absolutely true. It isn't you or us. It didn't have to be you or us. It is now, and that's because we've allowed a small artificial supply of these vaccines to continue in the pandemic without doing something about it. And so very simply, what could have been done when the U.S. funneled billions of dollars to Moderna, to Pfizer in pre-orders for their vaccines, what they could have done is to say, we're giving you these vast sums of money for vaccines for our people, who it is our constitutional duty to protect, but we want you to allow other manufacturers to make these vaccines in countries you have no interest in operating in or doing business in, right? So that we can do two things at the same time: protect ourselves and protect the rest of the world tangibly.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Achal Prabhula, and again, public health activist, coordinator of something called Access IBSA, campaigning for access to medicines in India, Brazil, and South Africa. He joins us from India. Also with us is Krishna Udayakumar, and he's a physician, I should say, at Duke University, the founding director of the Duke Global Health Innovation Center. And you can join us. Any questions or comments? That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Krishna, anything you want to say in response to what Achal just said there?
I do. First, I'll note that for the sake of transparency, I should make clear our group at Duke works with lots of governments, but we also work with the private sector, including biopharmaceutical companies. I agree with Achal that supply is a key constraint at the moment. Our research has really shown that it's much more complex than whether pharmaceuticals have monopolies and whether IP rights are protected or not. Vaccines are pretty complex to manufacture. They often take dozens of suppliers coming together across multiple countries to bring different components of the product. They're quite different based on which vaccine platform you're using. So what we have seen is really an unprecedented, to go back to that term, unprecedented increase in manufacturing capacity already being put in place. And we should recognize that it takes 3, 6, 9 months of investment and upskilling to be able to bring online a new manufacturing plant. So investments that were made last year and earlier this year will really start to pay off in the coming months. And the research we just released last week shows that if the currently public projections hold, we could get, by the end of 2021, about 12 billion doses of COVID vaccine produced and out to the world, which is many billions more than we thought would be feasible just weeks ago.
I feel like there's a but. I mean, after that sentence, I mean, that would, of course, allow the world to be fully vaccinated. What's going to prevent that, Krishna?
The complications are one. these projections almost never hold in both positive and negative ways. That we've seen this incredibly dynamic. People run into supply chain issues. They solve supply chain issues. So a lot of things would have to come together for the 12 billion doses number to continue to hold. Secondly, we may get to a point where we start to recognize that not all vaccines are the same, especially as we start to think about which vaccines may be more effective for certain populations or against certain variants and their distribution. So we have to make sure that not only do we get vaccines manufactured, but we also have to solve for vaccination. We have to get the right vaccine to the right place. We've got to have supply chain, the people to actually do the vaccinations. We've got to have the data systems. It's probably going to take something on the order of $100 billion to actually make sure that global vaccinations happen, or more, and that's money we also don't have at the moment.
And Nichelle, I mean, certainly in this country, one of the things we have learned from the pandemic and this effort to try to get vaccines to everybody is the infrastructure, that we have an infrastructure that is built in many ways on disparities. People who have access to health care and people who struggle to get access to health care. From a global perspective, is that also an issue, which is how do you, as Krisha just described, you know, how do you get this vaccine out to the people that need it, and do they have the infrastructure to support that?
Look, these are good points, right? And I think that the best way to understand this is that for the drugs that we take, that the things that we normally think of as pharmaceuticals, they are a one-ingredient recipe. I'm not sure you can have any recipes that have only one ingredient, but nevertheless, they are.
We get what you're saying. Yes. No, go ahead.
Vaccines are a two-ingredient recipe. So there are two kinds of layers of monopoly around them. One of them consists of patents, which are typically expressed through intellectual property. And the other layer of monopoly is the know-how, the actual technology to make that vaccine, right? And so if you want to have a Pfizer vaccine produced outside the United States or Europe, where it's currently being made, Pfizer would have to share both those ingredients to another manufacturer to get these vaccines made. Sure, it takes time to develop this infrastructure and make these vaccines elsewhere, but one of the myths, I think, that has allowed the pharmaceutical industry to get away with, unfortunately, in this situation, murder, is that there isn't manufacturing capacity outside the West. Now, it's difficult to make these claims sometimes when you realize that there are mRNA, which is the vaccine technology that Pfizer and Moderna use, where there are mRNA vaccines under production in India, under trial in China, in a number of other parts of the world. There are facilities that could be repurposed to make mRNA vaccines. And I just want to say, in the United States and Europe, if you dialed back exactly 1 year, there was no infrastructure to make mRNA
That's right.
vaccines because they'd never been made before, right? So you know, we could go back 1 year and say, oh, well, you'll never be able to make it in the United States because we've never done this before. But yet, magically, we have these vaccines. So it's clearly possible to do that. It's possible to outfit existing production facilities of pharmaceuticals to produce mRNA vaccines, as well as all the other vaccines, by the way. So there are many Western vaccines which are not using as pioneering a technology as the Pfizer and Moderna ones are. They're using older platforms, and these vaccines are being made by the billions, not just in India, by the way, but in places like Thailand, in places like Russia or China or South Africa. So there is a wide global infrastructure that is available. It's just not being used as efficiently as it could, because Western pharmaceutical manufacturers primarily are sticking to their guns in this pandemic, and Western governments are allowing them to do that, to artificially restrict the supply of vaccines we could have in the world.
You use the word murder, that you think pharmaceutical companies are murdering people because of their policies and regulations?
Look, it's a strong word to use.
I started work
as a public health activist in 2002 during the HIV and AIDS crisis in Southern Africa and South Africa. I worked for the country's largest trade union. And let me tell you what happened there. So AIDS was turned into a chronic condition, a treatable disease in 1996. There were these miracle drugs called antiretrovirals that came to market in the United States through the very brave work of gay rights activists in groups such as ACT UP. Dr. Fauci was actually integrally involved with the effort at the NIH to speed up development and testing of these drugs. Now, when they came to market in 1996, they cost $10,000 a year because of monopolies that protected their exclusive right to make these drugs. Do you know when they reached South Africa and Southern Africa, where in some countries, the population of people who needed it was 20%. So one in five people in countries like South Africa and Botswana who were adults needed some kind of antiretroviral medication, right? It takes 17 hours to fly from New York to Johannesburg. It took 8 years for these medicines to reach South Africa and Southern Africa in 2004. And in the interim, millions of people died in Southern Africa. I don't know how else to describe it except as what I did.
Fair enough. And we don't have time to delve into that. Krishna, let me go back to you. And actually, just looking at a caller we can't squeeze on, unfortunately, saying this is Rick from Hocasin, Delaware. I lived in Guatemala, Mexico. How can these countries pay for these vaccines? You talk about production, but who has the money to pay for them? Look at Brazil. Can you speak to that, Krishna?
Yeah, just to go back 1 minute, Achal, I have great respect for the amazing work he's done over decades. I would just respectfully disagree that monopolies are the only bottleneck here that we need to solve for. I think it's a much more complex picture of what's needed around the world, and there is much that public health officials and public officials, frankly, could be doing in more effective ways, in addition to work that our private sector leaders can and should be doing. In terms of financing, you're right, we're tens of billions of dollars short in what we need. We have mechanisms like foreign aid and COVAX as a way to at least cover aspects of this, so up to 20% of populations to be covered for 92 or so of the poorest countries in the world. But what we are seeing is that middle-income countries are largely being squeezed by both sides, where they're not covered through foreign aid and development financing. And on the other hand, they don't have the domestic financing to be able to play on the same field as rich countries to try to get to the front of the line. So we are seeing this in places like Mexico and in Peru and others where they're being squeezed and having to look at every option that's available for them to get access to vaccines.
I wish we could go on. We do have to end our conversation. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times, giving us a lot to think about. Thank you, gentlemen. And coming up, we'll be talking about variants and what we need to know. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're just talking about why containing the coronavirus pandemic in other parts of the world matters here in the United States and how to make global vaccine distribution more equitable. But now, variants. One characteristic of viruses, they constantly change through mutation, creating new variants. As the world works to contain the pandemic, it is in a race against these mutations. Think the South African variant, the UK variant, the Brazil variant, that appear to spread more quickly and more easily. So what do we know now about these viruses, these variants, and the vaccines? And joining us is Dr. Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at Georgetown Center for Global Health, Science, and Security. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me back, Marty.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, you can always join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Angela, I checked in with the New York Times. As of yesterday, 55,621 new cases of coronavirus. That's down 8% from 2 weeks. There were 650 deaths, down 35% from 2 weeks ago. Is this a sign that vaccines are working?
I think it's partly a sign that vaccines are working and partly a sign that in many communities, virus prevalence overall has gone down. And so we are reaping the benefits of that. But one thing people really should keep in mind is that this is not entirely due to vaccines. We've certainly stepped up our vaccination efforts in the past few months. but we still have a long way to go. We still don't have the majority of people vaccinated, which is what we're really going to need to sustain those declines.
In fact, I was also looking just to check in to make sure I had my facts and figures together for you. As of now, 14% of Americans are fully vaccinated. 25% of Americans have had at least one dose. So we're on track, but obviously not even close to something like herd immunity.
That's correct. And based on new data from places that have already had high prevalence of COVID and still have high levels of COVID circulating, we think that the herd immunity threshold is actually pretty high. So that's why it's even more important for people to continue to take precautions as we roll out the vaccine. And of course, to take the vaccine once it becomes available to them.
Now, we have several vaccines and some still in production, largely to deal with the virus that was identified last year in 2020. And now we have these new variants. Help us understand what a virus does and why it mutates.
Sure, absolutely. So this is, I think, something that's pretty confusing for people who think of viruses as one thing that doesn't really change very much. But to virologists like me, we know that viruses, one thing that they do is they change all the time. They evolve every time, essentially, they replicate or copy their own genomes. So variants have been emerging actually through the entire pandemic, but they haven't actually been doing anything. So every time the virus copies its genetic material, it can make a mistake, like a typo. When that mistake is not corrected, sometimes it has no effect. Sometimes it can have a bad effect on the virus. And sometimes if the virus gets lucky, it can have an advantage for the virus. It can make it better at being a virus, at replicating, at transmitting to another person. Sometimes it can cause more severe disease or it can evade the immune system. We've unfortunately had so many opportunities for the virus to replicate and acquire these mutations, but now we're beginning to see these mutations emerge that do confer some type of advantage to the virus, and that's what these variants of concern are. So some of them can replicate more efficiently and transmit to people more efficiently. Some of them appear to be capable of evading some of the antibody responses that are produced either by infection or vaccination. So that's why we're worried about them.
I understand. Use the word opportunities, and just to translate so that make sure our listeners and I know what you're referring to. So the more cases we have, the more chance for a variant. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. So every time the virus is replicating, meaning every time the virus is copying itself in a new host, in a new cell that it's infected, it's basically like buying a lottery ticket. The virus will get these mutations just in the course of copying itself. And every time it copies itself, that's an opportunity for it to win this evolutionary lottery, in which case it will have some sort of advantage. This mutation will occur in a spot that gives it some type of advantage for virusing, to put it.
Yes, I realize. Yeah, trying to make the language work for all of us. I mentioned the South African variant, the UK variant, the Brazil variant. I'm assuming that there are others. And it seems that the UK variant is the one that's really growing here in the United States. Is that correct?
That's correct. So the B.1.1.7 variant, which was first discovered in the UK, is by far the most prevalent here. But we also should keep in mind that there is the B.1.351 variant that was first discovered in South Africa and the P.1 variant from Brazil. There are also new variants that are homegrown variants, the B.1.429 variant discovered in California and the B.1.526 variant discovered in New York that are also gaining a foothold in some places in the U.S. So we need to be thinking about all of these because they all do effectively different things. The B.1.1.7 variant from the UK is more transmissible, and it also looks like it can cause more severe disease in people. The other variants that I just mentioned are capable of evading some of the antibody responses that are produced by vaccination. Now, that's not to say that they're completely resistant to the vaccines. They're not. But that does mean that they might be able to spread more easily even among a vaccinated population. So we do need to continue taking precautions to reduce transmission as well as getting vaccinated.
And those precautions are the things, you know, the mantra of 2020, masking, distancing, washing your hands, you know, don't go to crowded restaurants and bars, things like that. Correct?
That's absolutely correct. And one thing I'd really like to emphasize, and this gets back to what we started talking about at the beginning of this conversation, is that vaccination is fantastic. And it long-term is our way out of this pandemic. But we also, in the meantime, need to be getting transmission down, because herd immunity, like variants, is really a number game. It means that basically enough people are immune that a virus won't be able to spread through a population because it won't get opportunities to find a new host that it can replicate in. If we can also take those precautions that you just mentioned, masking, distancing, ventilating, washing hands, et cetera, we will get transmission down, and that's going to create fewer opportunities in the population even before we've reached herd immunity.
In preparation for this interview, I was doing my homework, and I ran across a quote that the goal of vaccination is détente, the idea that humans and viruses can coexist, not eradication. What do you think about it? Is that how you think about what we're dealing with?
I do think about that this way for this particular virus. Eradication, which a lot of people have, I think, thought that the goal of vaccination is actually a really, really high bar to clear. Right. We've only actually ever eradicated two viruses, one smallpox, the other is rinderpest, which is an agricultural pathogen, through vaccination. So eradication is not something that we normally actually can achieve with vaccines, but we can essentially eliminate viruses and, as you put it, reach détente, where the viruses still exist in the world. They're not completely eliminated, but they're not circulating through our population any longer.
I mean, the seasonal flu, something like that. I mean, we live with that. I mean, some people do die from it, but we largely live with that virus.
That's right. We live with a lot of viruses, and I think that people don't realize how much we are exposed to viruses. Many viruses actually cause very, very mild disease or don't cause disease at all. What vaccines prevent is actually disease. They don't necessarily prevent infection. Some of them do, and when that happens, that's wonderful, but not all of them do. The real thing is that vaccines keep us from getting sick. They keep us from going to the hospital, and they keep us from dying.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Dr. Angela Rasmussen, and she's a virologist at Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security, giving us an update on what we know about these variants, also the virus itself and vaccines. And again, you can join us, radiotimes at whyy.org. That's our email address. You can also tweet us at whyy Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Here's an email from Julia. Is there evidence that the coronavirus mutations also include variants that are less transmissible or less deadly?
So that's definitely possible, but those types of variants would actually be a disadvantage for the virus. So they're under what we call negative evolutionary selection. That means that the other variants that are more transmissible or potentially more pathogenic are going to outcompete those variants that provide a disadvantage to the virus. So while those variants do arise, unfortunately, they're not the ones that remain dominant in the circulating population of viruses.
Let me just pick up on something, and I think sometimes the language, you know, disease, virus, as a non-medical or non-science person, sometimes we use them interchangeably. And I guess the question, what you just said, was that the vaccine will prevent us from getting hopefully sick or really sick and ending up in the hospital. But do these vaccines stop transmission of the virus? What do we know about that now?
So that is a big question mark for all of these vaccines. The question is, do they provide what's called sterilizing immunity, meaning they prevent infection as well as preventing disease? And we don't have hard data to assign a number to that yet. But all of the data so far looks like they do have an impact on infection. So there were there was a strong decrease in the number of asymptomatic infections among vaccinated people now for several of the vaccines. In countries like Israel, where there's been a lot of vaccination, we've seen transmission really plummet. That indicates that the vaccine's probably having some effect, although we do need to keep in mind that there are other factors at play. In Israel, for example, at the very beginning of their vaccination campaign, they had a very restrictive lockdown, which also probably affected transmission in the community. So while we don't have really strong data that allows us to say these vaccines are preventing infection X percent of the time, we do think that they are going to have an impact, which means if they're preventing infection, in many cases, they're also going to prevent transmission.
You mentioned Israel, and before you joined us, we were getting a global perspective on this coronavirus pandemic. Can you speak to that and just sort of help us understand how, you know, frankly, what happens in Israel or other countries around the world, and there are, you know, more than 100 of them, that it will or could have an impact here in the United States, sort of being able to connect some of those dots?
Yeah, this is a really tough question because there's so many moving parts in every country. And in some cases, within every country, different communities have responded to the virus differently. They have different rates of coronavirus prevalence, and they have different access to vaccines. But the bottom line is that we really do need to be doing a better job at getting vaccines out to the rest of the world. One very unfortunate consequence of how some nations, including the U.S., have responded is that they have really put their own people first, which is understandable, but they've effectively been hoarding vaccine doses. And this is going to be bad in the long run, because even if we get rid of the virus here and we don't have it really circulating and we get most of our population immunized, the virus will still have opportunities to circulate elsewhere in the world. We might see new variants emerge that could potentially be able to evade the vaccine. So we really do need to be thinking about globally what the situation is, because a pandemic, by definition, is a global public health crisis. It's not something that's restricted to the U.S. or to individual European countries or Canada or anywhere. This is something that we're all in together.
Well, and we've all seen pictures now from Miami Beach where you've got unmasked crowds of people, you know, enjoying the warm weather, the beaches, the bars, the you know, social activities. When you look at that, what do you say to yourself? Or what would you say to those people there?
I think at least they're outside. But at the same time, I do wish that that people were not thinking that this is all over, or that because they are younger or don't have any comorbidities that they're not at risk. Because situations like that, you know, if they're all outside together, that means that they're all together inside as well, at the very least when they're going to the airport to travel to Miami Beach. So I really do wish that people would keep in mind that we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. That light is getting bigger as we are approaching the end of the tunnel, but we're not at the end of the tunnel yet. We are still in the midst of a pandemic, and I really wish that people would just stick it out a little bit longer.
And we're almost out of time here, but I mean, you do see a light at the end of the tunnel, a real light?
I do. We've had incredible news about a number of different vaccines, all of which work, even though there has been issues in communicating about some of them, like the AstraZeneca vaccine, for example. These vaccines are all fantastic. They all reduce the likelihood that you're going to get sick from COVID-19. They are our way out of this. And we're getting more and more supply every day. We're being conscious of how to distribute these vaccines better. I think that we are approaching the end of the tunnel. But again, we're not there yet. How long it takes to get there is really up to us.
Well, as always, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Dr. Angela Rasmussen, virologist at Georgetown Center for Global Health, Science and Security, thank you so much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Adam Stanishevsky, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.